On this episode of The Big Number, we look into the lunacy that is the continued excellence of LeBron James and raise the question, does he have four Hall of Fame worthy careers? We then look into the dominating performance of the San Antonio Spurs and their blowout win over the Minnesota Timberwolves. And finally, Daryl Morey is out in Philly. What does it mean for the future of the Sixers? All this and more coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, we are joined by your man, my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on?
Tom, for a hater like me, sorry, I'm getting choked up over here. For someone who is a hater of teams' fans, teams' fan bases, now we're whittling away teams. Get out of here. Sick of seeing you guys. Now we're down to six. Before we know it, it might be down even further than that. We're approaching the time where there's one game a night. And like, I gotta say, it makes my life a lot easier when there's one thing to focus on. And so I'm living my best life right now. And there's a lot to celebrate here. And also here at Yahoo Sports in general, right, Tom?
That's right, Dan. The all new 2026 soccer pick'em. It's here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament, Dan. So what you can do is make picks each round, earn points, and climb the leaderboard. You see it right there. You can play solo. You can create a private group with friends. You can join a public group to play with other fans. Or you can join our Yahoo Sports group to see if you can beat us. Good luck.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to be able to do that, Dan.
As a pretty big soccer guy, I think you're going to have a hard time knocking me off the top of the mountain. But if you are a hater of me, you can certainly join up. As you know, we've established Turnabout's fair play. I'm hating on you guys. You can hate on me. Let's join up this Yahoo Sports pick'em with Fox One here. Let's make something happen ahead of the big tournament.
Yeah, join us at yahoofantasy.com/soccer pick'em. We've got lots of stuff going on here at Yahoo Sports, but the NBA playoffs are, as you said, we're winding down to the final four here. The Knicks and OKC have punched their ticket, but you know what? There's a big free agent to be here in the NBA, and his name is LeBron James, which brings us to our big number this week. Dan, this week's big number is four. That's the number of Hall of Fame careers that LeBron James has put together in his career. Yeah, I said it, four Hall of Fame careers by LeBron James in the NBA. And I did this for Yahoo Sports this week, wrote this column, because one of those careers is with just the Lakers. If you look at the numbers that he's put up with the Lakers in the last eight seasons, LeBron James has eight All-Stars, seven All-NBA appearances. He's got a championship, and he's had some pretty big bonkers box score numbers. And when you plug all of those numbers into the Basketball Reference Hall of Fame calculator, which is a model that has predicted Hall of Fame induction, whether you're inducted into the Hall of Fame or not, based on a bunch of stats and a bunch of accolades, it has done a statistical analysis to see what are the things that matter when it comes to your Hall of Fame credentials. And it determined that All-Stars, whether you won a title or not, your peak performance is measured by win shares in the regular season. Also, how many times you're in the top 10 in the leaderboard, in points, rebounds, assists, blocks, steals, and minutes played. All that stuff matters. And when you plug it in for four separate stints in LeBron James's career, the first Cleveland stint, the Miami stint, the second Cleveland stint, and then the Lakers stint, they were all more than 50% likely to be incredible. Hall of Fame worthy, which is just bonkers. Look here, the credentials for LeBron since he joined the Lakers in 2018, eight All-Stars, seven All-NBA appearances, and a title. No player in the NBA since LeBron became a Laker has more All-Stars, more All-NBA appearances, and of course, of those guys that have matched that, Giannis Antetokounmpo and Nikola Jokic with eight and seven apiece, they each won a title. So you can say with pretty good certainty that no other player in the NBA can match LeBron James's tenure with the Lakers over the last eight seasons. And that guy was 33, 34 years old when he started with the Lakers. Dan, as we talk about LeBron's tenure with the Lakers, as potential that he has played his last game with the Lakers, how do you see it? Like, how do you compartmentalize what we just saw from LeBron James over the last 8 years as he enters free agency, potentially leaving the Lakers this summer?
Yeah, I don't know what people would want to evaluate it as a greater success, right? Like, they won a championship. They went to the Western Conference Finals. Beyond that, he provided the individual spark. Like, we should probably try to remember back to where the Lakers were before he got there, right? Like, the years of we're drafting D'Angelo Russell and Julius Randle and Brandon Ingram and Josh Hart, and like, where they got a Jordan Clarkson, like a nice core of players for sure. And like, that wound up, you know, going on to positive things around the league. But the Lakers were a perennial laughingstock for a number of years, right? In the aftermath of Kobe Bryant's retirement, the Lakers were, it was the most, like, the longest down period in franchise history, and or recent history at least. And LeBron's arrival did not immediately turn that around, but it did turn it around, right? On comes Anthony Davis, on comes a championship, on comes perennial postseason, you know, appearances and, you know, long stays and games of consequence, which hadn't been there for a number of years. So, yes, you could say that one title in 8 years is a, you know, not the rate of return you might be looking for from the organizational perspective, but in an era where we haven't had a repeat champion since the KD Warriors, in an era where the parity at the top of the mountain is higher than it's been maybe ever, getting one ain't half bad. And I think a lot of it comes back to many people are going to downgrade the validity and the value of the bubble title. That is an argument that, you know, reasonable people can have as long as they want to, and unreasonable people certainly do have all the time. But I mean, to me, like, you win one, you get put yourself in position where they were in that Final Four, they were in the Western Conference Finals. They ran up against like the buzzsaw Nuggets in those situations. Like, they're in difficult spots against ascendant teams. They didn't achieve as much as they would have wanted, but LeBron like shows up, reestablishes like the, you know, shouts to Tom Zeller, Lakers exceptionalism, right? The idea of what, you know, this is the franchise and the status and the expectation. This is where it's supposed to be at. Yeah. And they get back to the top of the mountain. And his individual performance throughout that time, a period which, by the way, had seen him, like, he led the league in assists because he had to play point guard 1 year. He played center at a certain point when it was like, I think AD was hurt and they needed him to be a small ball five. He has at varying points filled like every different role where he's going from like the number one option, the highest usage guy, to making space for Luka, to suddenly like playing like Draymond for you know, a chunk of time this season as they needed him to shift to third. Like, he has done basically everything necessary for that organization over the last handful of years. And as you said, the individual accolades, the individual achievements, getting to the point where you are the leading scorer in NBA history, like, it'll never quite be, he'll never reach that Lakers firmament because he wasn't of them, right? Like, Kareem was in a different way, and Kobe certainly, and Magic certainly. Like, these are guys, Jerry West to some degree, like, they are in the blood and bones of the organization in a different way. But for a hired gun, I don't know how much more you could have asked for than what LeBron has given since he got there 8 years ago. And your point about, like, this is a fourth different Hall of Fame career, put into perspective just like how remarkable the individual chapters of LeBron's run are. The number that hit my ear so much was eight. Like, holy cow, it's been 8 years since he got there. Where did that go? When did that happen? But yeah, like, that he's been there as long as he was in Miami and then the second run in Cleveland. It's mind-blowing to consider. But so much about LeBron is mind-blowing to consider at this point.
Yeah, here's the breakdown, Dan. So this is based on the Basketball Reference Hall of Fame calculator, the predictor. And what it does is it only looks at your NBA credentials. It does not consider the fact that LeBron's gotten gold medals all over the place throughout his career. It has not considered his high school career. It has not considered All-Stars, for example, if you were, All-Star performances, this model also doesn't consider your numbers in the postseason. So that's relevant because you're looking at this, the 99% Hall of Fame probability based on his first Cleveland stint with 7 seasons, 6 All-Stars, didn't win a title, but was a monster statistically. And in the postseason, 99% Hall of Fame probability. In the second stint, Miami, when he went to Miami for 4 seasons, 4 All-Stars, 2 titles, this is an incredible stretch of his career, 95.6% Hall of Fame probability. The Lakers stint, 8 years, 8 All-Stars, a title and a bunch of points. You know, he was top 10 in assists 3 years, won the assist title, like you mentioned, and also is a guy that was top 10 in points there at one point there with the Lakers. And so when you look at all of it, his Hall of Fame probability there was basically a lock at 87% Hall of Fame probability with the Lakers. Then you look at the second stint with Cleveland, and this is the one that Michael Redd, of all people, did not expect.
Shout out to Michael Redd. Yeah.
To be chiming in, but dude is really smart. If you follow him on social, you can tell that this guy has a very bright post-playing career future. He's really sharp. And he was like, wait a minute. Only 50% likelihood, 50.5% likelihood of him being a Hall of Famer based on his second stint with the Cleveland Cavaliers. That feels like maybe his best stretch of his career. And whether you want to argue that or not, whether it was the peak LeBron, what I will point out here is that this model is not my model. First of all, this is the Basketball Reference model that has been pretty accurate at predicting whether you're in the Hall of Fame or not. But when you plug in LeBron's 4-year career with the Cavs, one thing that is not accounted for is 4 finals trips. This model, when looking at the ballots or the players that get into the Hall of Fame as players, it found that the finals does not matter. Like getting to the finals does not matter. But what does matter is whether you win a championship or not. So like, I don't know who would be Jeff Hornacek, for example, getting to the NBA finals a bunch of times with the Jazz does not really move the needle for that player. John Stockton and Carmelo would already be in the Hall of Fame based on their numbers already. But that's why it's not as high as you think, the second Cleveland stand at 51%. It also, like, not only does it not consider your team success if you don't win the NBA finals, it also doesn't consider your postseason averages, Dan. So LeBron, when he was with the Cavs in that second stint, like the Delhi teams, when he went to the NBA finals and pushed pushed the Warriors to 6 games, the numbers in that series were ridiculous. And his postseason numbers in Cleveland in that second stint, 31 points per game, 10 rebounds per game, 8 assists per game. His PER, his player efficiency rating, went from 27 to 29 in the postseason. You rarely see like production jump that much in the playoffs. So all those numbers are not incorporated into this model that says he is at 51%. But I think I would agree with Michael Redd in that I think if you incorporated the full, all 360, full resume for LeBron, including his postseason stats and how he went to the NBA Finals all 4 years, I think it's much higher than 50%. And I'll also point out, I've tried to do this with other players, 4 different Hall of Fame careers. I could not do it. You know, I could not find other careers like Tim Duncan or I guess you could throw in Kareem. Maybe he could get to 4. But I got this idea from a few years back when at ESPN they said that Tom Brady had 3 Hall of Fame careers. And I was like, oh my God, it's amazing. But doing it for LeBron, I was like, I bet you could get to 4. And sure enough, the LeBron Lakers stint is now eligible, or I guess qualifies on its own merits with 8 All-Star appearances, a title, and just, he was awesome. You know, like, we don't do this for the Washington Wizards, Michael Jordan. Like, we retroactively in our brains, we're like, yeah, they were bad teams. So like, how can we hold the fact they didn't make the playoffs in those 2 years with Kwame Brown and Larry Hughes? And I would counter, we don't do the same thing for LeBron James. We move the goalposts on LeBron. I'll just say this. If you don't think that the Lakers LeBron stint was a success, then I will call you a hater. That's just it. Like, full stop. If you don't see it as a successful run, 8 seasons, 8 All-Stars, 7 All-NBA, 2 Western Conference Finals, and a championship. What are we doing here? We want him to win a championship, not in the East, because it's easy in the East. LeBronto, all that, write it off. Do it in the West. Very Stu Gatzian. Do it in the West. And then he does it in the West. And now we got to discredit that. When every team in the bubble had the same exact advantages and disadvantages, and yet LeBron James and AD came out on top. If you want to argue AD had this unsustainable shooting stretch, everybody else had no fans and could have had a hot shooting stretch like AD had. And it just seems like if you do not believe that LeBron James was a success in with the Lakers, I think you either have had your head in the sand or you are just an Michael Jordan stan to such a degree that you will not see LeBron James on its merits and you'll have to tear him down no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. And you know, we know everybody gets entrenched, right? You know, the battle lines get drawn and you just dig your heels in and you're not going to be moved off your spot. And that's the way a lot of this discussion goes. But I mean, it's wild to me. Well, many thoughts, because there's so much interesting stuff in the article you wrote, the column you wrote at Yahoo Sports and this discussion, and Michael Redd pushing back. Like, I love that Michael Redd pushing back or having some further thoughts is something that can happen now. Like, social media has many downsides, but Michael Redd can shout you out, which is pretty cool. LeBron, I think the thing to think about with the second Cleveland stint, he only played 301 games there. It was 4 years, right? I just did a little quick stat head search because this is another resource we've got. The only people that are in the Hall of Fame with that few games who have made, you know, fewer than 4 All-Star games, like what LeBron had in that period, it's almost exclusively coaches and international guys. Like, it's, you know, Al McGuire, yeah, John Thompson, George Karl, Billy Donovan, Drazen Petrovic, Dino Raja, right? Like, it's guys that just didn't, you know, are in the Hall of Fame for other reasons, largely, right? And so the idea that he could only play 4 years in a place, only play 300 regular season games in a place, and the production and the achievements is still overwhelming enough that it could be better than a coin flip is, you know, bonkers in its own way. Something that I think we get inured to some degree is, like, I was walking to school with my daughter and my wife this morning, and she was like, "Do you think that LeBron," she said, "not to act like your editor, but do you think it would be surprising if LeBron retired?" And I was like, where did my 8-year-old get this sports talk topic from? But all right, sure, do it. And I said, yeah, I think so. I think it would be surprising because he's still really good. And my wife said, how good was he? Is he right now? I said, well, he's like 41 and he just averaged like 23-7-7 in the playoffs and was like the best player on a team that made the second round. She was like, so does he just sort of assume he can do this forever? And I said, I think he does, right? Like, I don't know why he, and I don't know why he wouldn't, right? Like, you know, I can remember saying years ago, it'll be interesting to see, like, when LeBron hits 40 or whatever, and he gets into that, like, late period Jason Kidd arc of his career, where he's like, I understand the game and I can grind the pace down and I can I can see every angle and pick out the passes to make. I can't really move my body all that much, but just on size and skill and touch and vision, I can make it happen. But that Jason Kidd was like, I have to become a 3-point shooter or else I'm done. I can't do anything else really physically. And this LeBron is averaging 23-7-7 in the playoffs while being the guy that you focus on if you're like the Thunder defense at 41. And that's like, we've never seen a career like this. I think JJ Redick has been saying that over the course of the, like, in praising LeBron and in talking about him over the course of the year. Like, people can say whatever they want about different, you know, who you think is the greatest of all time. And do you think that Jordan is just unassailable there? Do you think that what Kareem did and the way he did it at the time he did it gives him primacy? Do you think that Bill Russell with the titles belongs higher in that hierarchy, whatever? But just the idea that we've never seen a career like this, I think your framing of it underscores that very neatly, and that we arrive at a place where he now enters unrestricted free agency, which I think is that the first time since the decision for him to be in UFA as opposed to like on a 1+1 that he tears up the option. I don't have that in front of me, but I think it might be that he arrives at a place where it's not only what comes next, but you can make a legitimate argument that he's the best free agent on the market. Like the way he played this year, if he actually is on the market, why would you not want to sign LeBron James? Because he's probably the best player you can reasonably get.
Yeah, I did the numbers going into that final game against OKC. His averages in this postseason as a 41-year-old had not been done by James Harden at any postseason or Steph Curry at any postseason, and like five other hugely talented all-time Hall of Famers had never averaged the numbers that LeBron had averaged in a postseason. And it's like, he's at 41. He's 41 years old and doing this, you know? And so let's flip this forward real quick.
Yeah.
When we're talking about that unrestricted free agency and what he does, I think the Golden State Warriors are a really interesting landing spot for him for all the reasons we know, watching that Olympic team with Steph Curry and under Steve Kerr. I think it's plausible for sure that he would go to the Golden State Warriors. Return to the Lakers probably is the favorite here, but after reading Dave McMenamin's report that came out on Wednesday, Dan, the little anecdote about what the what some Lakers officials were, the little parlor game that we're playing, can you explain this to me or share it with the audience? Because I think it's one of the great little anecdotes and details of the LeBron era with the Lakers.
Yeah, and you know, who better to get those than Dave McMenamin, who has now covered LeBron day in, day out for years, going back to Cleveland. But a really good story at ESPN.com, you know, we should shout that out. The story goes as follows. As the season played out, Lakers officials would on occasion partake in a parlor game of sorts during games. Sources told ESPN, an onlooker was asked to observe James play for a stretch, disregard his name and age, and evaluate his play to come up with a salary number that anonymous player would deserve next season. It was their attempt to gauge a fair market price for James's services. Would it be the full mid-level exception, $14.1 million, $20 million, $25 million, $30? LA's exercise to crowdsource a market value for James might have seemed harmless, but comparing James, the 2020 Finals MVP, to an anonymous 6'9", 250-pound skills vessel could be viewed by James's camp as insulting at best and lunacy at worst. First of all, let you be downgraded or denigrated to the degree that somebody calls you a skills vessel. Yes, it does not recognize the totality of a person's what they bring to the table, but having multiple skills that then could be contained in any vessel, pretty good. There's worse things to be called. But I think that framing, while it is wild to envision like just Lakers front office people being like, yeah, I don't know, like imagine who, you know, take the name off the back, what would you pay him? Just the idea of people, like, imagine if people be like, I don't think we should say that about LeBron. Like, I don't want that to get around because then maybe it'll show up in a story like this. I think the exercise, the framing, the way to present it, like it's the stuff that the Lakers have to figure out, right? Like because they don't just have to deal with LeBron's free agency here. Austin Reeves has a player option that he's going to decline and then be looking for a significant raise on the deal that he made, because he was about to make $14.9 million. Reporting has suggested, you know, he might be looking for something north of 40. Jake Fisher back in December had reported that there might be multiple max level offers out there for him at the 25% max, which would be up around 41, 42 million. Like that's possible. There's a ton of other Lakers who are either about to hit free agency or have options. And the Lakers have to look at it and say, the whole goal now is retrofitting this roster around Luka Doncic. And how do we do that and elevate ourselves to the point where we can reasonably believe we can challenge in Oklahoma City? Like this series, this 4-0 sweep, yes, Luka was not available, but the result of it laid bare the gap that exists between where the Lakers are as like a third or fourth best team in the West and the top of the West. And if you are aiming at titles, you have to do what is necessary to build the roster that can get you there. How do you do that with LeBron on a market rate deal? How do you sell LeBron on a like $30 million pay cut after he just did everything that we just talked about, and after he was the last one available at the end of the regular season and into the first round of the playoffs? And oh, by the way, they won a playoff series with Luka out and Austin Reeves out. So like, it's a lot to figure out for Rob Pelinka and that front office, which is changing and adjusting and being added to. And I think what you, how you value LeBron now, what kind of offer you present to him, how he receives that offer, and then what the plan to do move forward around it is, like, that's all pretty interesting inside baseball stuff inside the halls of Crypto.com Arena. I wonder how it's all going to play out there. But if nothing else, we know, like, LeBron ends the season healthy and productive and looking, you know, yes, he doesn't know what he's going to do next, but he doesn't look like someone who's about to retire. So then, you know, yeah, where he suits up next ought to be fascinating.
Yeah, I'd imagine a lot of people dancing. Talk to me when the big number is five, when he gets five Hall of Fame careers. You know,
that's right.
That would be. I think the logical response here is like, why not five, Tom? You know, talk to me when he gets to five Hall of Fame careers. And you know what? To your family, he might just do it. He might just end up playing right. long enough to have five Hall of Fame careers. Because certainly averaging 20 and 6 at age 41, there's gonna be a lot of teams that want that. All right, we've got other playoff games to talk about. We're gonna talk Wemby. We're gonna talk Spurs. We're gonna talk this incredible performance from Wemby in this Minnesota Timberwolves series. We're also gonna talk about Daryl Morey later in the show, him being fired by the Philadelphia 76ers. So stay tuned. We will get to all that coming up later in the show. All right, Dan. So this week's big number is 4. That is the number of Hall of Fame careers that LeBron likely has had, likely put together based on the Basketball Reference Hall of Fame probability model. That's absurd. But also absurd is that we've got a guy who might actually, you know, compete with that 4 Hall of Fame numbers careers, because Victor Wembanyama is on the goat path. Like, he has been so good in this postseason, and the way that he has played, I think people are rightfully getting ahead of ourselves with the OKC San Antonio potential conference finals, but it's been so fun to watch. And yeah, this series, we got to spend some time talking about this. So Dan, with your first little number, I would like to hear one of your insights into this series between the Spurs and the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, first little number this week is 95.3, which is the Wolves' offensive rating with Victor Wembanyama on the floor in the second round of the playoffs. That is pretty low. That would be, you know, like early process Sixers, Charlotte Bobcats level of offensive ineptitude. And that is what the Wolves have been putting up when Wemby's been on the court. For the full season, the Wolves' offensive rating was 115.6, so 20 full points higher than this. And in round one against Denver, 112.8. And this is significantly lower than that. With Wemby around, and obviously, yes, Anthony Edwards limited, Dante DiVincenzo out, Ayo Dosunmu missing time. You know, there are mitigating factors, to be fair. However, the degree to which the offense has cratered when Wembanyama's on the floor is kind of incredible. Should also just say, for the record, the Wolves are down now 3-2 in the series after a blowout 126-97 loss to the Spurs in Game 5. So Spurs take a 3-2 lead heading back to Minnesota for Game 6 on Friday night. So just staking the series where it's at there. With Wembanyama on the floor, the Wolves are shooting 39.2% from the field. That's really low. With him defending at the basket, so layups and dunk attempts, normally converted at well into the high 60%, they're 9-for-20 at the rim with Wembanyama as the closest defender. That's 45% on dunk and layup attempts, according to Second Spectrum's tracking. That does not take into account, by the way, all the times, and you hear him talk about it on the broadcast, or as people write about it, the U-turns, right? The nopes, the hell nahs, whatever you want to call them, when a driver goes towards the paint, sees him there, and just turns back around and gets it exit stage left and heads out the other way. It's remarkable to see it happening even against a team that has an all-time, all NBA caliber offensive player like Anthony Edwards, and that is as tough as nails as the Wolves have proven themselves to be. The Spurs now have, they've got three losses in the playoffs, and two of them are in games that Wembanyama did not finish. The one where he got the concussion against the Trailblazers, and the one where he was ejected for the elbow to Naz Reid. And even in that other one, the game one loss in the series where Minnesota stole home court advantage, the Spurs were still plus five in Victor's 40 minutes, despite him going 5 for 17 from the floor. Oh, and he blocked more shots in a single game than anybody has since Wilt Chamberlain in 1970. So yeah, you know, it's been pretty tough for the Wolves to score with that guy on the floor. And if they can't change that in the next couple of games, there is a very good chance we are looking at the Spurs getting to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, amazing. 95.3, the defensive rating when he's on the floor, or I guess Minnesota's offensive rating when he's on the floor. Also, yeah, the Blazers, when he was on the floor, their offensive rating was not 95.3, it was 95.7. So pretty consistent impact.
Consistency, yeah.
Yeah, pretty good Victor Wembanyama. Look at this chart here that I put together. He said 22 blocks in this series. He's blocked 8 different Minnesota Timberwolves players. The only player that has like been on the floor for more than 50 minutes that has not been blocked by Victor Wembanyama is, of course, the smallest guy on the floor. Our old sage in the NBA, Mike Conley, has yet to be blocked by Victor Wembanyama, which just seems like a time warp clerical error that just does not compute in my brain that the smallest guy has yet to be blocked. But shouts to Mike Conley from evading.
He's
the
staying away.
So far.
He's like, I'm not going anywhere near that guy. I'm staying all the way out here. Fire from a distance. He can't get me out here. I do love this, though, that it's number one of the bullet is Jaden McDaniels, because if nothing else, what this postseason has taught us is that Jaden McDaniels does not care. He will just keep going. Like he respects nobody and nothing and will keep going at it. And if you throw it back in his face, who cares? I'm coming back at you again.
On this note, Jalen Clark, I think, is 1 for 2 when Victor Wembanyama's on the floor. Kyle Anderson is, I think, in like 2 minutes on the floor of the Wemby. He has only taken 1 3-pointer. So very smart move by Slow-Mo. Just not even try. But it's nuts. I mean, when he's, you mentioned the shooting percentages when he's nearby in this series. I'll also point out that the average 2-point shot distance when he's on the floor for the Minnesota Timberwolves, when he's on the floor versus off the floor, it goes from, according to PBPstats.com, it goes from 5.35 feet away from the basket when he's off the floor to 7.35 when he's on the floor. So on average, they're taking shots 2 feet farther away. On average, every time he's on the floor, it just pushes everybody out further and further. And when he's on the floor, this is another crazy one. 1 out of 5 shots at the rim are being blocked when he's on the floor. So I mean, wow. It's just 20% of the shots at the rim are being blocked when he's on the floor. And that's not all Wemby, but probably 95% of those block shots are Wemby. So just to give you an idea, like Julius Randle, when you look at him and the shot profile that he has, completely changes when Wemby's on the floor. You look at when Stephon Castle is guarding him, or whether it's Keldon Johnson guarding him. As long as Wemby's back there, guys just don't want to go at him. You know, Mike Conley, smart, just like, yeah, I'm just going to pull up in the mid-range here and do that little dipsy-do Rajon Rondo thing, which is a classic Mike Conley move, but also something that we don't see Rudy Gobert having any success with, is trying to go at Victor Wembanyama. And there you see it, Naz Reid trying and failing a lot of the time. So, yeah, Wemby has had a massive impact defensively. And all this, we haven't even talked about his offense. And by the way, he's averaging 20 points a game.
Right. Yeah, he had 25-17-5 in the game 5 win. So yeah, when you 27-17-5. When you arrive at the place where it's just like he's giving it to you on both ends in that way, like what are you supposed to do with that? And I think the answer is, generally speaking, when he's available and plays the full game, you don't win all that often. And that is the challenge facing the Wolves here. Another challenge, or I guess another facet of that same challenge, is our second little number, 39.4, which is Julius Randle's effective field goal percentage. through five games in this series. Effective field goal percentage is just an adjusted stat that takes into account that a three-point basket is worth 1.5 times more than a two, right? Like three is more than two. EFG helps sort of show that out. If having an effective field goal percentage under 40% sounds bad, that's because it is. Among the 51 players averaging at least 20 minutes a game in the second round of the playoffs, 39.4 for Randle is the fifth lowest mark. The only players below that are like guards who are playing an outsized role or a bigger role than they're supposed to be. Terrence Shannon, Marcus Smart, Danis Jenkins, Ayo Dosunmu. Also funny that two of the four smaller are also against the Spurs. Makes sense. But it is a drastic drop from Randle's regular season mark, 52.6%. Which is not like elite in and of itself, but is significantly better. And that is the return of a troubling postseason trend when you're talking about Julius Randle. Knicks fans remember this well. His first two playoff runs, 40.2 EFG, really, really down there. Seemed to turn things around last year in the run to the Western Conference Finals with the Wolves. Got up to 56.8 as he played the best ball of his postseason career. Now, though, down to 46.2 against Denver, and again, all the way down to 39.4 against the Spurs. With Ant limited, without Dante DiVincenzo, with Ayo Dosunmu working through issues, the Wolves have really needed Randle to be that second shot creator, second shot maker. And with Stephon Castle's defense and Wembanyama back there and Keldon Johnson getting physical with them, he just has not been able to provide what they needed there. So I'm wondering, like, at this stage, the Wolves backs are against the wall. Do you see an opportunity for Randle to kind of come out swinging? Do you see Chris Finch juggling the lineups, juggling the matchups? How do you see a pathway for the Wolves to get Julius Randle going here and extend their season?
He's got to get under Wemby's skin and try to get him ejected again. I don't see any other way, because Julius Randle has not been able to bully Stephon Castle nearly as much as you think. Like, you put Steph Castle on Julius Randle, you'd be like, oh, he's just going to take him into the paint and just back him down, put his shoulder into him, and then get his buckets. But as you're seeing in these clips, if you're watching this on YouTube, which you should, at Yahoo NBA on our YouTube channel, there's a lot of clips where he's either afraid to go into the paint because Wemby's lurking, or he goes into the paint and then finds it is just a brick wall. And Castle deserves tons of credit here.
Absolutely.
On guarding him, he has been the primary defender on Julius Randle. And according to NBA player tracking technology, he is shooting 7 of 23 against Stephon Castle in this series when he's being the primary defender on Julius Randle. Not good. 7 of 23 shooting. And against Wemby, in the 40 possessions that he's being guarded by Wemby, he is shooting 5 of 20. So, Dan, when you combine the Area 51... Area 51 being Stephon Castle, number 5, and Victor Wembanyama, number 1. You put those two together, Julius Randle is shooting 12 of 47 when guarded by Area 51. That is 11 of 33 on twos. That's 33% shooting on two-pointers inside the arc, and 1 for 14 on threes. So if you're getting pushed out to the three-point line, you got to hit a bunch of them, because otherwise you're going to be a completely ineffective scorer. And that's exactly what Julius Randle has been in this series. He's the swing factor. Like, we know that Anthony Edwards is going to get his 20, 25 points, but where are they going to get that secondary scoring? And Julius Randle last year was able to provide that. This year, he's run into Area 51 and it's been a disaster for him.
Yeah, you wound up in there and he's not getting out. I think the choices facing Chris Finch are, none of them are particularly appealing here, because their offense has just been drawn dead when it's Randle and Gobert. And I think it's like 90.5 points per 100 possessions with the two of them on the floor. And that's just like, it's untenable. Like, you're starting the game down 10 points basically when that's the offense you're getting out of your starting front court. And so, like, it's been better marginally, but better when Randle and Naz Reid have shared the floor, because they can space, they can stretch the floor a little bit, at least theoretically draw Wembanyama out of the paint, as opposed to giving him Gobert to just sort of park him by the rim. And you know, Gobert has not been able to, you know, make anything really happen when he's gotten the ball. I think he's averaging like 3 made field goals a game. He's shooting under 42% from the free throw line, you know, dropping the ball, turning it over. Like, it's just not Gobert's not going to be able to give you much offensively in this series. But then, like, if you move Rudy to the bench and put Naz Reid out there to start the game to try to open up the offense, you know, do you risk losing the guy that was the linchpin of your round one win over the Nuggets, right? Like, that is a difficult political and internal choice to make. So, I mean, the answer here is Julius Randle needs to be a hell of a lot better and make more of these perimeter shots. When he did that last postseason, that was huge for the Wolves being able to get to the third round. That is looking a little bit more like the outlier than a leaf turned over or a corner turned. So we shall see as they head into game six. Something else to look forward to in game six, our third and final little number, 2. That is how many players have averaged at least 10 points per game on 50% shooting over multiple playoff series at age 20 or younger. Shouts to the folks at Stathead for helping me track that down. Magic Johnson did it in his rookie season, helping lead the Lakers to the 1980 NBA championship, and Dylan Harper is doing it right now. The number 2 pick in June's draft has been awesome in his first NBA postseason, averaging nearly 15 points, 6.5 rebounds, and 3 assists in 25 minutes per game off the bench in this series against Minnesota. He's shooting 62% on twos and 89% from the foul line as a rookie 20-year-old guard. Shouts to Rob Mahoney at The Ringer, just noted this. He has more buckets in the restricted area in round two than anybody but Chet and Victor. Dylan Harper, playing off the bench, the 6'5" guard, is 21 of 30 in the restricted area in round two. He is like a walking paint touch, smooth as silk, gets wherever he wants to go, totally unbothered, behind the back, bang, bang, on Iodasunmu, and then throws it down. Like, he's been sensational. And there are times where, you know, I don't want to get too far over my skis because, as you mentioned, Steph Castle's been awesome in terms of his offensive game, in addition to what he's doing defensively on Julius Randle. And De'Aaron Fox has been continuing the engine of North-South getting to the rim, even if he's not finishing well. But there have been times in the series where it's like, is Dylan Harper already the second best guy on the Spurs? Like, he just looks unbelievable. And like, 20-year-olds don't do this in this deep into their first season. But the size, the physicality, the pace, it's all there. And that's a big reason why San Antonio hasn't really experienced much of a drop-off, even with Fox struggling, to the point where they're now one win away from the conference finals. I don't have a great question here, Tom. Do you also think it's cool that Dylan Harper looks like this?
It's awesome. It's awesome. How often do we see a rookie performing like this? They almost never contribute to a championship aspiring team. Almost like contribute, period. Play, period. We see this. Like, actually being one of the best players on the floor. And how many times, Dan, have you watched him play and been completely confident that he's going to make the right play? Every time.
Oh, absolutely.
I've never looked at a 19, 20-year-old with the same sort of maturity and expectation that he's going to make a really winning advantage play. It never happens. We never see this for a rookie, much less one that's 20 years old. When you do all these like historical, how many times have we seen rookies score this much? They're all 22, 23, 24 years old rookies. A 20-year-old doing this. And just turned 20, by the way. It's absurd. Like, he had a 16 PER in the regular season. That's now 20 in the postseason. He had a 0.13 win shares per 48. Basically, you can say 13 win shares per 48. Now that's at 23, almost doubled his productivity in the postseason. You just never see this. Usually rookies under the bright lights, the size, the experience, they wither in the postseason. And this guy has blossomed in ways that is so fun. And I also think, like, where are we in this pod? Like, 50 minutes into this, we haven't even said De'Aaron Fox once. And he's like their second best guy on the team. And that's how important these guys are, is that Dylan Harper, Stephon Castle, Keldon Johnson, these guys are stepping up in ways that make, oh yeah, they have De'Aaron Fox too, a real statement. So Dylan Harper, I keep saying this, and it has import when it comes to the draft upcoming. Stop discounting or underrating these second-gen NBA players. There's something about it where the sons of NBA players continue to be tough as nails and outrageously productive at the next level. And Dylan Harper is yet another example of a guy whose dad played in the NBA, and yet it feels like coming into the league, still a little underrated coming in, because I think a lot of us anchor ourselves in who their dad was, who Carlos Boozer was, and it colors the way we envision that player to be, the son of an NBA player to be. And Dylan Harper is absolutely ready for this moment. And I think a lot of it has to do with he's kind of just steeped in this from living in the same household with Ron Harper, who's been down this road before. So I just think it's another data point to suggest that we are always criminally underrating the sons of NBA players. And we can laugh all we want about Bronny James and how he was selected at 55, and that the Lakers did them, you know, a favor there. I mean, Bronny is another example, not the shiniest example, but Dylan Harper, Jalen Brunson, Devin Booker, Andrew Wiggins, Kobe Bryant, Kevin Love, Domantas Sabonis. We're going down the line. These second gen guys are so good and so much better than we thought coming in to the league. And Dylan Harper is another example.
Yeah, if you can arrive at this place, like, it's not too big for you. And I think you're right. There's an idea that, like, if you have experienced it before, if that's like the kind of thing that you are prepared for from birth, right? Like, maybe it doesn't feel quite as big and quite as bright and quite as loud. And right now, the loudest thing about Dylan Harper is the impact that he's making on the floor. And if the Wolves are not able to, with their reserve guards, be able to, you know, respond in kind, if you're not going to get a big Terrence Shannon Jr. game, you're going to get a big Ayo Dosunmu game, you're not going to get Mike Conley, you know, popping for a few threes to, you know, sort of tilt one of those small stretches, the Wolves could find themselves looking up at the lights here. And Dylan Harper, those lights have not been too bright for him, not even by a little bit.
Yeah, it's really special to watch. Another reason why I picked the Spurs to win it all is I just think in today's league, your youth is actually an advantage. Is just, I think a lot of the miles that we see is like the Timberwolves look old. The Spurs look so much better in this series, covering more ground, playing more physicality. And they've been able to withstand all of that playoff experience on the Timberwolves side, where guys like Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper are the best players on the floor for long stretches. And Victor Wembanyama, people, you know, will point to the fact this is his first playoff experience. He doesn't look scared at all. So Spurs, I hope they close this out and we can get San Antonio OKC. Just selfishly, I know we're not supposed to root as journalists. We're not supposed to root for, matchups, but I really want to see OKC and San Antonio. We're hours away from potentially that happening. You know, one team that's on this Oklahoma City Thunder is Jared McCain and also Isaiah Joe, both guys who were handpicked by Daryl Morey in Philly and then ended up elsewhere succeeding for OKC. We're going to talk about Daryl Morey, who's no longer the president of basketball operations for the Philadelphia 76ers, despite taking down the Boston Celtics in the first round and getting that Sam Hinkie gif, the Rudy gif out here just a couple days ago. And now Daryl Morey's out. So we're going to talk about that and the Sixers and where we go from here coming up in a little bit. Some news on Tuesday, Dan, that the from ESPN's Shams Charania, that the Daryl Morey is no longer the head of decision-making for the Philadelphia 76ers, and that Bob Myers is going to be taking over in the interim to kind of figure out who's going to fill that seat for Daryl Morey, a guy who came from the Houston Rockets via the Boston Celtics organization and still searching for his first title and not going to get one with the Philadelphia 76ers. Didn't get into the conference finals like many were hoping that they'd be able to puncture that glass ceiling that has been there for Joel Embiid and the 76ers. This is a surprise to me, man. I felt like, given the way that they dismantled the Boston Celtics that many believe were the East favorites going into this postseason, the fact that the Sixers finally beat them and exorcised those demons, that would have, at the very least, given Daryl Morey an extra year to build around this roster But Dan, were they that bad against the Knicks? That bad that Nick Nurse is staying on, but Daryl Morey is out? Because you covered that series. Was there a moment where you said, I don't even know if Nick Nurse and Daryl Morey are going to survive this? It was that bad. But like, if you look at the numbers, yes, it was a sweep, but the sheer magnitude of that sweep, 22.3 average margin of loss, not margin of victory, of average margin of loss in that series, the second largest deficit for any conference semifinal for any team historically. The other one was 2010 Orlando Magic, when they beat the Hawks, and the Hawks coach at that time, Woody, got fired and Larry Drew took over. So there were casualties in that instance, and there was here, but I kind of thought, I feel like it was a little bit of house money for the 76ers after what they did to the Boston Celtics, but evidently not. Joshua Harris decided, and Bob Myers decided, yep, we're gonna take out Daryl Morey here with multi-years left reportedly on his deal. Did you think that this was a possibility?
I thought it might be possible when I looked at what the Sixers were showing up with on a night-to-night basis. And I'm like, you know, Nick Nurse is kind of like the last Tibbs standing. He's going to play his starters a million minutes. Like, that's what he wants to do, and understandably so. But then I look at, you know, you look at the other options, and I'm like, he trusts five guys in this roster. Six if you count Quentin Grimes. Like, and then I look at it, and you're thinking, well, why aren't more guys getting a shot at the bottom rungs of this roster? Like Dominic Barlow. Yeah, he can play a little bit. Why can't Justin Edwards get a couple of minutes here and there? And you're like, sure, okay, Justin Edwards. And you're like, Andre Drummond. Sure, you can probably only rely on Andre Drummond, but so much as a backup center at this point in his career. Kyle Lowry's on this roster. Oh, right. Kyle Lowry is a player on this roster. He's not just like a consultant or a coach. Trendon Watford, Adem Bona, Jabari Walker, Dalen Terry, Jani Broome. Like, there's not a lot of guys past that top six that you're like, well, that's a bona fide NBA player that I for sure know I can trust in a playoff series. And that is when you look at that and you're like, well, it's not just that Nick Nurse is a madman, although he's somewhat of a madman. There's not much in the cupboard when you're reaching for ingredients. And that's the part where I was like, oh, if they get annihilated here, maybe Daryl Morey, like the spotlight goes more specifically on Daryl Morey there, because the roster construction is essentially, it's like drafting a fantasy team of like stars and scrubs, where you're going to like spend all your auction money on the very top of the league. And then you're like, well, I'll stream whoever else I need to based on matchup. And I'll just like churn through the waiver wire every week to build out the rest of the roster. And that, I think, to the extent that you can say Daryl Morey ran out, you know, his time is up for a legitimate reason, it would be he built a roster with a strategy of the only thing that matters is get the top end talent. The most important part is get the top end talent.
Yep.
And we, as we have talked about a number of times on this show, the NBA model now is not a big three model. It is a big 10 model, right? It's a big nine model. Like, you need that depth. You saw what the Spurs were, or sorry, what the Thunder were last year, what the Pacers were last year, what the Celtics were before that, where they were like a big 6-7 sort of rotation. And you're seeing that with teams playing lower mid. It was wild to watch a Knicks playoff series and have the conversation about a coach not trusting the rest of his roster and a GM not building a deep enough bench not be about the Knicks. It was very, a jarring juxtaposition. But that is, and so I think that happening and them getting so summarily embarrassed by the Knicks, the emotional like cliff, the absolute falling off a cliff of the heights of the feelings of the Sixers comeback against the Celtics to immediately annihilated in that second round matchup, and that it happened right away. It was like from the win of game seven on Saturday night to getting beat by a billion points in game one on Monday night. Like, there was no time between. I think that emotion factors into it. I think that coming on the heels of, or that happening while Jared McCain is shooting like 70% from 3-point range for Oklahoma City after you traded him away at the trade deadline and then said, I'm quite confident we sold high on Jared McCain. in a press conference explaining the move, like at a time where you couldn't take Tyrese Maxey off the floor because you had no other playable guards. And then Jared McCain is just like, I'm just going to pop over. And every time I get in the game, I hit four threes. Like all of these things make it, you know, the optics of it kind of put, I feel like it put Morey under the microscope here. And none of those individual things might be the reason why it happened. But I think you come to a point where it's like, yeah, they've been one of the, you know, I guess like all told in his tenure, you know, I think like sixth or seventh in terms of regular season win percentage. Like there haven't been a lot of teams that have performed better in the regular season. They've consistently made the playoffs except for the injury, you know, haunted last year. They've won multiple playoff series, mostly against bad teams until this year, beating the Celtics. But it just, the results were not good enough to justify going forward with it, to make an affirmative case for sticking with it. And so Daryl Morey winds up on the outside looking in.
112 is this week's big number. That is the number of millions of dollars that Paul George and Joel Embiid are making next year. The cap is being eaten up by $112 million for those two guys next year. The following year, it's 120. So $63 million for Joel Embiid and 57 for Paul George. 57, Paul George, that's a player option. So he could pick that up or decide to become a free agent. And then the following year, there's a player option for Joel Embiid at $67 million. I think that, above all else, is the reason why Daryl Morey is unemployed right now, is that Josh Harris was looking at the future and the cap and the apron world and just saying, maybe I need to bring in someone that is willing to see those as a sunk cost and moving off of those contracts. Because I don't see Daryl Morey being able to pull that off because of the whole investment bias that we see all the time in the business world, in our daily lives, is just like, I'm going to try to justify giving those contracts to those players because that my job depends on it. Whereas a new GM or a new head of basketball ops might come in and say, that was the previous guy. I will take a 30 cents on the dollar deal to get off that money so that I don't have to deal with that sitting on my books. Good luck with that. You know, I just don't see that as a logical, you know, avenue, a path forward for success, is looking at those contracts and saying, like, I want to undo what Daryl Morey did, and I'm willing to eat a lot of whatever bad contract they have to take the other direction, or the first rounders they got to send to whatever team to get Paul George off my cap. I don't see that as like a real pathway either. So to me, it reminds me of Sam Hinkie getting ousted. Is Josh, there's a psychic value in having a GM that is not going to embarrass your family or your name or your brand. Because I think about how loud the Knicks were in that game four, the Knicks fans were. And maybe there was just something emotional about that experience for Josh Harris, that he was hearing 80% of the fans there at going Knicks chants, and how loud, how it turned into what seemed like to be Madison Square Garden. And maybe there is an emotional component to this, that the owner just said, we can't do this anymore. Like, I know how good the vibes were beating Boston in that series, but whatever this is, we got to do something about it. And I'm surprised it wasn't Nick Nurse, considering the fact that with Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey, and Paul George on the floor in that series against the Knicks, the defensive rating for the Sixers was 145. I'm going to say that again. With Joel Embiid, Paul George, who were outstanding defensively against the Boston Celtics, and guys who were perennially in the conversation for all defense when they're healthy, those three guys, Tyrese Maxey, Joel Embiid, and Paul George, when they were on the floor against the New York Knicks, they surrendered 145 points every 100 possessions to the Knicks. So is that a Daryl Morey issue? Is that a Nick Nurse issue? Well, we know what the ownership group thought. It's that Daryl Morey is at fault for that.
Yeah, the Daryl Morey, or the Nick Nurse issue there, I don't know what the tactical adjustment you were going to make was that would make Joel Embiid more ambulatory in space guarding a pick and roll. Because that's the Celtics didn't hammer that. the Knicks saw, oh, if we draw him up into the pick and roll and then Jalen Brunson goes at him, or we make him guard Towns 30 feet away from the basket, like, we're going to get everything we want. It's going to be like busting open a pinata. And it worked, and they went back to it over and over and over again. And as far as, like, on the other end, how do we get Tyrese Maxey back to where he was, you know, lighting the world on fire against the Celtics? Well, the Knicks, I mean, some of it is Tyrese Maxey jammed his finger on a dunk, I believe, early in game two, and then had, you know, really struggled with his handle and his confidence shooting the ball. But part of it was also, like, the Knicks just smothered him, and the Knicks had more guys to throw with them. And that is, these are the things that go back to Daryl Morey. Like, if the roster isn't deep enough, and if there aren't enough options for the coach to play, yeah, if the coach doesn't play the options he has, he can wind up, wondering what happened to his job, a la Tom Thibodeau at the end of the Eastern Conference Finals last year, right? But, like, if the coach doesn't feel like the options there are really going to be providing positive play, and then the stars you put on the floor can't play up to their level, whether due to injury or matchup or whatever, like, you don't have a whole lot of outs. And it's funny to hear you say whoever comes in next is going to have to make the decision of, like, well, do we attach assets to try to get off these contracts or whatever? Like, that, I think we forget that's what Daryl Morey had to do too, right? Like, he took over a job where the Sixers were, like, had given a 9-figure deal to Al Horford, and that didn't work even a little bit, right? And Josh Richardson was there because that was the sign and trade return for moving Jimmy Butler after the Tobias Harris over me situation, right? Like, the Sixers are, you know, like, it's like the great American novel, all that happens to them year to year and over the course of history, where you're like, oh my God, right, that's what was going on there. But Daryl Morey took that job, and like the first thing he did was, I'm going to send a pick with Horford to, like, park him in Oklahoma City, the tanking and rebuilding Thunder at that point, so that we can move, like, untie this glut in the front court. And he brings back in, you know, it gets off of Josh Richardson. They bring back Danny Green and Seth Curry, and they win a bunch of games and they make it to the playoffs, right? Like, the Ben Simmons situation is soured, like, after he melts down against the Hawks in a situation where the Sixers probably should have made the conference finals there. He figures out, okay, Ben Simmons is holding out and not, or holding in, whatever. He's at the practice facility, but he's not playing. All right, we turn him into James Harden. And then they win 54 games, which is the most the Sixers had won since the Iverson finals team. They had the third best offense in the NBA. Embiid wins MVP. They have a 3-2 lead on the Celtics in the second round of the playoffs with game 6 at home and a lead midway through the fourth quarter. And then they choke that away. And the Sixers lose game 6. They lose game 7 by a billion points on Mother's Day. They've got a thing for getting massacred on Mother's Day in this era, and that has not been a good vibe for them. But, like, there's the sense of, like, it's, you know, and the Daryl Morey, Billy Beane connections have been made a million times over, but, like, my blank doesn't work in the playoffs. Like, there's a certain amount of that where it's like, what Daryl Morey did with this roster was continually build, like, 50-ish or higher win teams that could win a playoff round. And then it's like, well, when it gets to, you know, squeaky bum time and in the second round of the playoffs in these tight and late games, are we able to get over the hump? And they never have. And so, like, you can disparage individual moves. You can, you know, quibble with strategies. Certainly some things, like, you know, you watch Julian Champagne playing for the Spurs in what might be the conference finals, and you're like, the Sixers cut him so they could sign Mac McClung so that he could perform in a Sixers uniform at All-Star Weekend. And, you know, wouldn't it be nice to, as you perpetually are looking for a power forward, might it not be nice to have Julian Champagne on the Sixers roster right now? Might it not be nice to have Isaiah Joe as you continually look for a starter or an off-the-bench shooter? Might Jared McCain have helped in that series? Like, there's a lot of things like that. But there's also a lot of, like, he's the guy that drafted Isaiah Joe and Paul Reed and, like, developed those guys into NBA players. He's like, there were a lot of successes along the way there. Maxey at 21, maybe you just got lucky it fell into your lap. But, like, that is a franchise alter, like, the arc of your franchise altering kind of deal, right? To wind up presiding over, yes, everything was haunted and horrible last season, but then at the third pick in the draft to stick and nail Vijay Edgecombe, right? Like, That's huge. And that is a potentially like the future of the franchise altering situation. When the Harden situation went south, able to flip him to get multiple firsts from the Clippers that are still coming. The pick from McCain is still coming. So whoever does come into this job, yes, there's like, it's like, what do you do with the Embiid and Paul George of it all? But like, there's also some stuff in the hopper too, right? And there's some stuff to be able to, some raw materials to work with. All of which is to say, there's plenty to dislike about the way that Daryl Morey, his tenure went and some of the decisions that he made, whether they were his or ownership inflicted or whatever. He's the one that has to wear them, and he's wearing them now. It is really wild to say, like, he came in to sort of finish Sam Hinkie's job, and then at the end of the day, it winds up being similarly like fraught and emotional and frustrating and nuts, and the job still isn't done. Maybe what that should point to is that it's really, really hard to get where you want to go in the NBA, maybe especially hard to do it in Philadelphia.
I mean, did you get the same sort of Colangelo vibes when Bob Myers is hired by Josh Harris a couple years ago? And I'm like, uh-oh, this is Sam Hinkie all over again. And sure enough, that's what happened. I'm not saying that Bob Myers is going to take over this and that they had plans to get rid of Daryl Morey as soon as Bob Myers came on board with Josh Harris's ownership group. But it did feel weird to see Bob Myers sitting next to Josh Harris courtside during the playoffs and not seeing Daryl Morey there. And I know Daryl Morey famously can't watch playoff games because it makes him too nervous to watch. But at the same time, it kind of seemed like the writing was on the wall. And as someone who's been at the Sloan Conference and has watched Bob Myers and Daryl Morey debate on the stage, it's a weird setup. And I got to imagine the leadership structure there was probably weird for Daryl Morey too. And I'll just point out, when they signed Joel Embiid to that 3-year, $190 million extension a couple years ago, it was Josh Harris who is all over that deal, took the picture with Joel Embiid at the signing table. It wasn't Daryl Morey. And in the statement, it was Josh Harris talking about how excited he is to bring in Joel Embiid on this monster extension. So to me, Joshua Harris wanted that to be his signing, wanted to be the face of that deal. And now I think Daryl Morey is being kicked out of the door in large part because I think untangling themselves from this Joel Embiid and Paul George situation, he's the one who's going to be the casualty. So, this is the quote from Brian Windhorst on Get Up. He has 3 years, $192 million. Yeah, by the way, the extension hasn't kicked in yet. That's next year. Brian says, I can promise him he will definitely be back. He is not going anywhere. So I guess what this says is that Josh Harris and Bob Myers felt like Daryl Morey did not build around Joel Embiid well enough. And that's it. But VJ Edgecombe and Tyrese Maxey, if those are your hits, you're doing a pretty good job. And someone will be getting Daryl Morey's services, I think, in short order. And I wonder if Dallas or Chicago, who have you, kind of feel like if Daryl Morey was available, maybe their president of basketball operations search goes a little bit differently. So we'll see. I suspect he'll take another job soon. Or he might just pull a Tom Thibodeau and go on sabbatical for a couple of years while he counts his money. So we'll see. But before we go, I just wanted to say this has been a really hard week in the NBA for all of us who've been covering this league and seeing Brandon Clark and Jason Collins pass away. Yesterday was a really rough day. And just wanted, before we wrap up the show, just wanted to offer condolences, thoughts, prayers, all of that to the families involved. Just kind of one of those, it's hard to talk about the NBA and analyze the league when you lose two of these important figures. And so I just wanted to say before we go, really sorry to see that news, and hope that the NBA as a community, as a family and fans, that we can rally and offer support to those who need it, especially those families involved. So, and the teams, those players certainly touched a lot of people and the game. So just wanted to say that before we go. I want to see what we're going to talk about next week for the big number. Can't wait to do that next week, next Wednesday, because probably is going to be down to four teams here by the time we tape it next week. Dan, we also want to give a shout out to Emmy and Brad behind the scenes, Sarah, for producing this show. Thank you so much. Don't forget about the soccer pick'em for the big tournament coming up, as we mentioned at the top of the show. And please subscribe to Yahoo NBA at our YouTube channel, where you can get the Dunker Spot and Kevin O'Connor show every week. I will be back on KOC next tomorrow. Within 24 hours, we'll be live at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. So go rate, give us a 5-star review wherever you listen to us on podcasts. And Dan, have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week.
Stay safe, everybody.